Welcome back to another episode of Rebuilding the Palisades podcast, hosted by DSI. I'm Zach Fagan, and today we are joined by the illustrious Michael Kovac, renowned architect and principal of Kovac Design Studio. Michael, thank you very much for coming in and talking to us today.
My pleasure.
Well, I like to start out by just kind of getting a little bit of background on our guest. Tell me, how did you originally get into architecture?
It's interesting. Before we started this, we were talking about Japan, and I spent a little bit of my early childhood in Japan and in Okinawa, and was interested in that sort of culture. And before I started Kovac Design Studio, which now we've actually just shortened to Kovac, so it's less of a mouthful. But I was planning on going back to Japan to work. I was taking Japanese at UCLA, and my goal was to go work for Ondo. And I stumbled into working on a health club project here in Los Angeles, and thought, well, I'll do this project and then I'll leave. And then I met someone who was running one of the major studios through my former employer, and just it was going to be a small project. It turned into basically an all-new house, and then another house with the same client, and then kind of kept going from there. So that's how things got started for me.
Wow, interesting. So you didn't end up working for Ondo.
I did not, no.
very, very unique style that he has indeed. Are there any other, well-known or, you know, historical architects that let me back up a little bit. Did you take any inspiration from what Ondo has done and applied that to any of the projects that you've done at your studio?
Certainly. I the thing that was attractive to me about the prospect of going to work for Ondo was not just Ondo as an architect, but also Asia as an Eastern culture and a different way of looking at the world than the West. I'd traveled in Europe quite a bit already and feel quite familiar with Europe. And, you know, it's very closely related in terms of how they look at the world to the U.S., I think. And in Asia, it's just a different sensibility. They're looking at different time horizons. They're looking at just kind of everything differently. So I wanted to understand how they saw the world and then also how they perceive the West. I wanted to kind of understand ourselves from an outsider's perspective. So that was my goal. And then the sort of vehicle for that was Ondo. And I was and am interested in the power that he can imbue in his architecture with just so few elements, usually just concrete and light, mm-hmm. and things can be just spiritually powerful with so few elements. So I thought that was quite attractive to me. And then I've from time to time we collaborate with other architects, international architects, to work in projects in Los Angeles, and that's been an interesting way for me and the studio to kind of further its education without having to go work for other people. So I started this firm super young, probably too young. I think normally I would recommend someone, you know, go travel the world and work for who you kind of are interested in and then start your own thing. Mm-hmm. Since I didn't do that, it's been rewarding for me to, in a way, bring them to me. So we've worked with people like Peter Zumthor, with Pawson, a number of international people that I have just a huge amount of respect for. And each of those firms brings their own way of working, their own interests, and those are all things then that we can learn from as a studio. So,
well, that's very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're interesting. Bring the influences to you instead of going to the influences. Yes. I love it. So I know that your firm specializes in, you know, hillside homes and kind of incorporating, you know, the environment, into your designs. What initially drew you know, your focus to that style?
You know, as far as the hillside aspect of it goes, I think it's one of those things that's self-perpetuating. Once you've done a couple of challenging typologies or projects in a specific challenging typology, then you become known for it. Mm. Fortunately, I'm personally drawn to hillsides. My own home in the Palisades is on the very kind of pretty much the top of the Palisades on a ridge. And I just love that sense of space and seeing distance and things like that. And then, you know, architecturally, I find it super interesting. We as a firm really feel like our projects, typically you couldn't pick them up and move them to another site and have them make sense. And that's even more so on a hillside lot. They're really truly kind of interwoven with the hills, and I think that just there's a lot of interesting sectional moves instead of just focusing on plan. That's sort of hard to describe in words, but I think, you know, either climbing a hill or descending a hill opens a lot of interesting architectural possibilities that are exciting to us as a firm.
Sure. Well, it's also challenging, right? Hillside builds are challenging for, you know, lots of reasons. You know, I know a bit about construction. I know that you typically in a hillside, either you're going to cantilever, you know, your foundation, or you have to drill caissons.
Right.
What kind of challenges do you see in the different, you know, hillside locations that you're working in with regard to, you know, soil composition and the different challenges in getting, you know, caissons installed at these sites?
That's interesting that you brought that specific example up, because again, my own home in the Palisades, it's effectively a three-story descending home. So it starts off on the street level and then goes down two more levels. And the original design was to have the middle level resting on the lower level directly with just, you know, columns that turned into foundations. But the way they created Chautauqua, my street, it was again a ridge, and back when that was subdivided, they just cut the ridge top off and threw the spoils over the side without you know, benching or compacting or anything else. So there's a layer of loose, junky soil on the site. And so it turned out that the less expensive way to hold up our second level was to cantilever it from closer to the street, as opposed to putting columns straight down. So, you know, learning the geology, of course, we're working with, you know, excellent geologists and civil engineers and things like that, but understanding the nuances of each specific site early on will inform the design and how we address our strategy, basically.
Yeah, very cool. Very cool. So you and your wife, Karina, have been, you know, longtime residents of the Palisades since, you know, like 02 or
exactly.
Something, right?
Yeah.
And the home you purchased was originally built in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
When you deconstructed it and, you know, made the decision to, you know, you donated a lot of the parts to, you know, Habitat for Humanity. What inspired that decision? And I guess a follow-up, what happened to those parts? Where did they go?
Yeah, I don't recall who brought this to our attention, that was just a thing one could do, but it's just one of those things, you know, you pick up and so we learned more about the program and worked with, I've forgotten the gentleman's name, if it was Arthur, but to basically a third party values your house and its components. And that sets a basis for a tax deduction with the IRS effectively. So you're donating this mm-hmm. to the IRS or to a nonprofit and then taking a deduction. And so we lived in the house about 5 years, and even though it was an older home, you know, we had some nice memories in there, and it had a nice life before us. And the thought of just bulldozing a house and taking it to landfill, you know, I guess we've anthropomorphized the house, but, you know, we felt like, wow, what did it do to deserve right. that? So the idea that we could sort of gently take it apart and donate it, and then people would take what they needed to make a new life for these things, was really exciting for us. And then there was a nominal sort of net economic benefit for doing that. So I say net benefit because what happens is the year you're doing this work, you're spending a bit more money to pay for deconstruction as opposed to just demolishing. But when you go to file your taxes in the next year, your deduction usually more than offsets that sort of extra amount. So it is an economic benefit to do this. That was it. It was nominal. It wasn't a big thing for us. It was more the philosophical idea of it. And in terms of who got to benefit from it, one of our friends, I don't even know if they knew that we had done this, but I heard from him later that he had gone there because he was building something for himself, and he recognized like a ridge beam from the old house, and he's like, "Wow, I saw part of your house. That's so cool." And so, you know, you never know. But it's everything from windows, it's, you know, toilets, faucets, it's the lumber, actually, the way the regulations are here, that I don't believe some of that, some parts of that are able to be reused here. They go to Mexico. Mm-hmm. So, but it's still reused.
Yeah.
We actually chopped up our old driveway and reused that ourselves on the new build. As a patio.
Wow.
So that was kind of cool.
Yeah, very cool. Very cool. I mean, there's so much energy that goes into, you know, digging up the raw materials to make all of these components, and then the energy to actually make them, and then to transport them, and someone purchased them and then installed them. And all of that is just for naught if you just bust it up and throw it away. And a lot of times it can have another life. You know, it's life isn't just because it's maybe not a fit for your home anymore, or if you're going to, you know, redo the home, that doesn't mean those parts necessarily need to go to the landfill. So that's very cool. Very cool that you're able to do that.
Discover why we're the most awarded home technology firm in the U.S. Our design-centric approach transforms your space with effortless control of lighting, motorized shades, audio, video, and more. Our friendly experts guide you every step of the way. No tech speak, just smart, stunning simplicity. We provide years of care from our award-winning service and support team. Experience technology that feels as good as it looks.
So you and your wife are both, you know, avid environmentalists. Your home, you know, is referred to as the Sycamore House, mm-hmm. And was designed, you know, as a laboratory, you mm-hmm. know, for sustainable architecture. Which sustainable strategies from that house have you carried over into, you know, other projects?
It's interesting because I love gadgets, which I suppose probably allies me with you guys, and technology. And we explored a lot of active technological systems in the house. So, you know, for instance, our hot water, the way we get hot water first is through solar hot water. If there's no sun, then we go to a heat pump that can heat or cool water. And if that's not making enough, then we have a gas-fired boiler as a third option. And so there's a lot of sort of if-then complexity to our house, which I have since shied away from, because it is a lot of complexity. And we've realized that when you do something like that, it usually is very tied to the people who built the system at the time. And when they have moved on, you're left with new people coming in and scratching their heads and not really understanding what's happening. And the things that I think work just as well are better and are things that are completely passive and rely on just frankly the laws of nature. So, you know, passive ventilation, cross ventilation or thermal mass, things like that. So we have really increasingly leaned into those kinds of ideas and de-emphasized the technological solutions and simplified the mechanical system. So now I'm favoring separating out and just using basically photovoltaic for electricity as much as possible with battery backup, and then having an all-electric home. The mechanical room becomes exponentially simpler, easier to maintain, and you know, is probably similar, if not less expensive to operate. So those are the kind of things that we learned. There's one small example I give. I mean, we kind of intentionally pushed the envelope to see what could work, knowing that it was our house, and if it didn't work, it was fine. It was a good lesson learned. Mm-hmm. So there was one. I am very into natural light and balanced light. I remember working in an office once where there was just a huge amount of natural light coming in from one end of the office and nothing on the other end. And so if you look towards the natural light, everyone was just a silhouette, and the people looking that way are squinting when you're looking back at them. So I've kind of had that negative example. So in our house, in the middle level, we have a family room that has a big sliding glass door to the view. And I wanted to get some natural light in on the backside to kind of balance that out. And it's below ground. So that wasn't necessarily possible. And I ran across what was billed as a fiber optic skylight. Mm-hmm. And what that meant was on the roof, there was a little box that was maybe 3 feet square, had 36 little lenses that tracked the sun and focused the sun's light on each one on the end of a fiber optic cable, fiber.
Yep.
And they bundled that all up, and then it went down into our family room and then spread back out into a cove. And so it created a light cove. So it was pretty cool. Like, you know, if a cloud went over, you know, it dimmed because it's just like a skylight. The problem is there was a maximum length limitation of 36 feet, I think it was, for that. That's what they said. And we were kind of towards that end. What I didn't understand, and they didn't really make clear, is fiber optic cable, the longer it is, the more the warm light drops out. So we were left with very cold, kind of bluish light.
The frequency range that you want is gone.
So
out.
We ended up taking that out, and I think the company's out of business. But it was interesting, you know. That was a very sort of tech heavy idea. But it was fun, and it's gone. It's replaced by a nice LED warm white light.
There you go. Yeah. Well, now the technology, lighting technology, has evolved to the extent that you can tune
exactly
whatever white
that's right.
You're really looking for.
Yeah.
Very cool. Well, the Sycamore House got LEED Platinum certification. Super cool. What all did you have to do in order to achieve that? And, you know, what was maybe the most challenging requirement that you needed to meet?
So, you know, we basically look to maximize everything across the board. Just, again, the standpoint of we wanted to see how far we could push things into the green envelope and then understand what worked and what didn't, as I just said. What was interesting about the way the LEED certification or point system is, there's different categories. And right off the bat, we were not able to get a number of points for things like walkability or access to mass transit because we're a mile away from Sunset Boulevard. Mm-hmm. So all those points are off the table already. So you're, you know, if you're trying to get LEED Platinum, it's getting harder. You know, you've less to shoot for. And then also there's a pretty stiff hit for size of home. And even though our home is 3,300 square feet, that's still, you know, LEED is trying to push you into a smaller home. So that was a thing. So one of the other challenges in terms of like looking at the pool of points that we could chase is normally there's a sort of rich cache of points in HVAC systems that you can go after by having a very efficient system. But they're all focused on forced air systems, which we didn't have. So our house is entirely heated and cooled by a radiant system in the floors and ceiling. So at the time, LEED had no way to deal with that. So all of the, like, are your ducts perfectly sealed? Is your heat pump, you know, rated to this or that? Those are all things that were not available to us. So we had to maximize all the points related to kind of recyclability of materials, local source materials, energy efficiency. We still were able to do great work with. And then we went after a lot of innovation points, you know, things like that fiber optic skylight or other things like that, that we actually had a lot of, they cap those. So we left a lot of those kind of on the table that we couldn't use, but they were still fun. So that was the kind of challenge of it, I think.
Wow, interesting. I didn't realize that they really focus so much on forced air. It seemed like they'd give you points for doing a passive system.
Yeah, it's evolved. I mean, keep in mind, our house was designed in 2007.
20-ish years ago.
Exactly, yeah. It finished in 2010. So it was an earlier version of LEED, and they've had to, you know, roll through several iterations since then.
Yeah. Are you involved in the Green Building Council at all?
Not the LEED currently. LEED system? I used to be. I probably would love to be again. It's just kind of time management at this point.
Sure. Yeah. Understood. So yeah, on the house, you know, there are, well, not necessarily on your house, but features like, you know, fiber cement siding, a green roof, insulated glazing, stuff like that, you know, are good ways, you know, for a house to, you know, survive, you know, a wildfire. Are all those elements included in the Sycamore house?
They are.
Okay. Definitely. So they are included.
Yeah.
So how did you decide on those specific elements?
Well, I will say that we were acutely aware of the fire risk when we built the house.
Mm-hmm.
We're friends with neighbors that had lived through the fire in 78, that are just, you know, people a couple doors down. And then obviously with their own kind of eyes and history of things like the Bel Air fire and stuff like that. So we knew what we were getting into, and we knew that had to be a priority for us. So we were only considering fire-resistant materials.
Mm.
So we weren't going to look at like wood siding or things like that, which is a, you know, a favorite material, but just not for this location.
Right.
So the fiber cement siding came about because we wanted something. We were trying to come up with a color palette that was very kind of soft and tied to the environment. We didn't want like a jarring color. So it's kind of an earthier color. We wanted something ideally that was a recycled material. So this EcoChem material is recycled newsprint and cement. So that is attractive to us. And then lastly, but critically, you know, we love art, and we love, again, specific of tying a project to a place. So when we bought the property, there were already three big sycamore trees on the property, and they cast magnificent shadows, and you know, that of course are changing through the day. And somewhere along the line, we befriended a local artist named Jill Sykes, and her work really centers on doing silhouettes of plant material in oil paint on canvas. But we had the idea to ask Jill to create a kind of hypothetical pattern of sycamore shadows that we sandblasted into this cement material. So you see this pattern kind of embossed into the side of the house. And then as the course of the day changes, you see the real sycamore shadows kind of come and travel across the sort of artistic interpretation of them. And just sort of that interplay is fantastic. So that's really how we came to choose that material. The green roof, living roof, is something that we knew we wanted to occupy the roof with a roof deck, and we didn't want to just kind of look at roofing. So this was a way to have something that was both beautiful. It helps with energy efficiency. It helps with habitat. You know, there's all sorts of pollinators and birds and things that love it up there. And it also helps with fire resistance.
Of course.
Because we have about 4.25 inches of soil on those areas where we have the green roof, which is magnificent. And then it also helps with slowing down water going into the storm sewer system, because it captures and holds quite a bit of that, and what it doesn't hold, it slows down. So that's how the green roof came to be. The insulating glass, we've developed a spec over the years that's addressing a few different issues at once. One of them is energy efficiency. So, you know, I was talking earlier about passive systems. So the greater the sort of insulation and thermal performance of the house, the less you're going to have you know, an air conditioning heating system keep up. So the house that we had on the property before from the 50s, in the winter, the heat would be blowing, and like the house is like, rah, 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 and then it would get hot and it would turn off. And in about 15 minutes, it'd be freezing cold. It felt like death again, because, you know, this leaky old single sure. glass house. And then that cycle would just kind of repeat. So we were, you know, by having a highly insulated home, including the glass, all of that can get moderated. So we did that for thermal efficiency. We did it for fire. And we also incorporate the outer piece of glass is tempered, which helps with fire, helps with security. And then the inner piece of glass is actually two pieces of 1/4-inch glass that are laminated together, like a car windshield. Mm-hmm. And that does a couple of things. One is it takes out pretty much all of the ultraviolet light that fades furniture, art, things finishes. Like that. Mm-hmm. So that's a huge benefit. And then also it has an acoustic benefit.
Of course.
So that's the assembly that we have for our glass, which is, you know, fantastic in all those ways.
Very cool. So on the living roof, I've always wanted to ask this question of an expert that knew the answer. What kind of R value are you getting in terms of, you know, better insulation with 4.5 inches of soil and all the waterproofing and everything, of course, that's, you know, that's underneath it? Are you getting a significant benefit in terms of, you know, rejecting, you know, infrared where the heat is and in sunlight? How much of a difference does that roof material really, really give you?
I can't off the top of my head quantify the R value, but the benefit would be less in the R value and more in the concept of, like you're saying, shading. Mm-hmm. So you're preventing the direct sunlight from hitting the roof membrane. And then secondarily, you're creating a fair bit of thermal mass. So that soil starts the day in the summer, let's say, cool from radiating heat overnight. And then during the course of the day, it's able to absorb quite a bit of heat before finally it's sort of full, if mm-hmm. you will, and then the heat starts to radiate down to the roof. So it's more helping the home thermally from a thermal mass and shading perspective than an insulation perspective, like you know, styrofoam or something like that would do.
But a similar effect, I mean, to great effect.
It's incredibly
effective. Oh, very cool. Yeah. And it's beautiful to look at, right?
It's got super fun.
Plants growing in it. And you walk around on it.
We do. And we have changed it two or three times over the 15 years that we've had it. So, you know, if we get tired or want to change the sort of scenery up there, we used a company called Live Roof, and they have a tray-based system. So they're just 2-foot by 4-foot trays. And what happens is we will design a new kind of garden, if you will, and we'll work with our friend Tom Hawkins there, and then they'll plant those trays up past Santa Barbara. And then when they're ready, meaning they're all fully grown, then a truck comes and then they just get placed down on the roof and the little dividers get pulled out and then it's done.
Very cool.
So it's like a 2-hour thing and you've changed your landscaping. And, you know, like right now we have a lot of California poppies and a kind of flowering mint and some Cecilaria grasses. And it's wonderful.
That's great.
Yeah.
That is great. So the home also has a FosCheck fire retardant system, which is on call. Is that practical for most homeowners? And, you know, would you recommend it widely?
So it's kind of more nuanced. So I have been, since the fires, kind of, first of all, it's incredibly effective, for sure. And it's, you know, it's a few tens of thousands of dollars, depending on the magnitude of the system, let's say. And in our case, we have a nice break on our homeowner's insurance for having that system. So there's some financial offset there. I don't think it's necessary for homes kind of a bit farther from the urban wildland interface. So what I would like to see, and I've actually talked to our insurance company about this, you know, to no avail, I'm sure, but you know, the insurance companies are either pulling out or wanting to raise rates, but you know, clearly that we, you know, we're kind of in a moment of crisis on that. And I was telling them, like, you know, instead of that, you know, why don't you use your leverage and say something like, look, we want to see homes that are with the first 100 feet from the wildlands to have this kind of a system. And that will keep us, yeah, that'll be one of the things that we will look at to say, sure, we'll stay and this makes sense. And the reason I say that is, even in the something like the Palisades fire, most of the fires, by far most of the fires, are started from embers. And embers are relatively easy to defend against if you do things like just non-combustible exterior materials, you've cleared, you know, vegetation away from your home, you don't have, you know, firewood leaned up against it, or, you know, a wood swing set, you know, 3 feet from your house. You know, some things that seem obvious, but those are you know, your vents, your don't let embers come in, things like that. So if we can control for embers in the sort of interior of the neighborhood, then what we really have to worry about is just when the fire's coming down the hill through the vegetation, there still is a line of contact, if you will, where there's a flame front. And those homes have to deal with embers, of course, first, but then they do have to deal with flame contact and that radiant heat. And that's where I would like to see all of us in that kind of region with something like a FosCheck system. Mm-hmm. So we sort of become the front line, if you will, for the neighborhood.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if it can possibly keep rates down overall,
right,
it seems like a fair, fair concession to make. Indeed, we definitely need a better line of defense. We've clearly seen that, not having something at that, at that wildland, urban juncture is, we've seen the effects.
Right.
Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
So, your experience shows which measures, worked, in your home. How do you educate other homeowners about these kind of strategies?
I've been on a number of panel discussions, I'm part of a number of neighborhood sort of chat groups, things like that. It's just, it's both formal settings, and a lot of informal things. And then, word of mouth, we'll get calls at the office, not infrequently, every few times a week, probably, with people that are not looking to hire us necessarily, but they would love to have some advice or some information about a material or what do we think about this. And we're trying to be as generous as possible with that because, we want to see the Palisades and Altadena, build back in a stronger, responsible way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed. So you previously stated, we can do this.
Yeah.
Right. There's not, hugely expensive ways, to rebuild. Can you elaborate on some kind of cost-effective ways that maybe folks overlook?
Sure. So, that kind of goes back to my statement a few minutes ago about most homes are lost due to embers. And if that's also the easiest thing to prevent from taking over homes. So, some time ago we got rid of wood shake roofs, which was a kind of a gimme.
Yeah.
But, if you think about that now, a dried up piece of really textured, wood on the roof. I mean, what a beautiful place to start a fire. So
right.
we're through with that. And the vents, I think, are something that is just an incredibly easy fix for people. The vents that most people have are oftentimes they're kind of compromised by someone kicking them or, some sort of damage.
Wires going in.
Yeah, or they're already a kind of too open of a weave because they're just trying to keep maybe a raccoon out or something like that. But, we need a smaller, let's say, eighth of an inch kind of size mesh. And then if you want to kind of bump that up a little bit, there's intumescent products that when they're exposed to high heat or direct contact with an ember, they actually puff up and completely close the vent off 100%. So those are pretty cool. And we're talking tens and hundreds of dollars, nothing more than that. People think things like, I'm going to put a metal roof on the house and I'm good. Well, the problem is if you put a metal roof over waterproofing over plywood, you're not necessarily good. So if you get a healthy, chunk of something land on your roof, the metal, as we know, conducts heat super well. So it'll conduct the heat right to the plywood and start the house off that way. So you need something like a Dens deck or something like that will give you a good solid assembly rating of an hour. And again, very inexpensive. Insulating glass is pretty hard to get away from now from an energy code point of view. And that's a place that I tell people if you can do even more than the minimum, you're going to enjoy the benefits of that year round in terms of thermal comfort and acoustic comfort and all those things. But it also helps you in a fire situation. And where that comes into play most is in something like the Alphabet Streets and the Palisades, where there's 40-foot wide lots with 5-foot setbacks. So you're 10 feet away from your neighbor. And because those are long, narrow homes, of course you're going to have glass on those long side walls. So if your neighbor's home is going up in flames, you're getting a huge amount of radiant heat 10 feet away from you. So at that point, you're going to wish you had a higher performance glass. And so it's not a big increase in cost, but that's some place I would look for. There's a kind of an odd loophole in the wildfire building code that still allows wood windows and wood trim pieces, which we highly discourage. If you're going to do a wood window, most companies at least offer aluminum cladding for the outside, which will save you in maintenance costs and will keep an ember from, you know, taking out your house.
Sure.
So that's something we push for. It's a little bunch of little things like that. It need not take it to where we did with our house. You know, first of all, we feel like we're in a more exposed location, and we were trying to kind of push the envelope to see these things. But
sure,
you know, that's not necessary for everyone.
Yeah, understood. How can the Sycamore House serve, you know, as a catalyst for change in the way architecture is approached? Do you think it can serve as a catalyst in some way?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, just by virtue of people seeing it standing alone kind of in the neighborhood up on the ridge, you know, there are certainly other examples of homes that have survived. Most of them, you know, maybe they're down in the canyon, so it's a little more favorable from a fire safety perspective, or perhaps they're in the kind of wind shadow of something else that survived. And then there's, of course, quirky things that you just have no explanation. But you know, people have seen our house just walking the neighborhood, seeing it on certainly a bunch of different media, you know, YouTube and all sorts of different outlets like that. And so, you know, I think it can be this point of optimism, like, hey, this thing was in the middle of all of that, and somehow it worked out. So what can we learn from that?
For sure. Yeah, and historically, you know, there have been disasters. This isn't the first disaster that struck humanity, right? And, you know, we tend to want to build back in the same area, right, that we've settled in. I guess I can think of a couple of other examples where we have maybe naively resettled. Mount Vesuvius, for example,
yeah.
You know, clear evidence of just an absolute destruction of, you know, of the city, yet people live right underneath the volcano again today. So as far as the rebuild process goes in the Palisades specifically, what are your opinions on, you know, how long it will take to get the neighborhood, you know, back to some semblance of kind of where it was before? And maybe your thoughts on, you know, long term, when will it be done? When will it be completely rebuilt and, you know, no lots open and back to being the Pacific Palisades again?
Yeah, so that is the question. I would say, for both better and worse, the Palisades that was there at the end of 2024 will not be there again. For better, in the sense that the new Palisades that replaces that will be a much safer community. So the homes that are going to go back, even if their people are really not trying to do anything special, the building codes and things like that are going to already do a pretty good job. So the prospect of catastrophic loss, in my opinion, of the scale that we had will go away. Not to say that houses won't burn, might lose 10, 12, who knows? But, thousands, I think that's behind us. Just as it is, you know, as we have hopefully helped manage earthquake risk over the years. And you know, at some point we will have another serious earthquake in the area, and homes will of course be lost and other buildings, but far fewer than there would have been 50 years ago. And it's the same to me with the fire situation. So, you know, the Palisades did have a lot of homes that were still from the 50s, you know, and they were just very fragile, you know, old things. And those were fire risks to themselves and to their neighbors, and those are gone. Now, the bad side about replacing those is that a lot of those homes were small because people couldn't afford to build something new or bigger or whatever on the property, and they were just comfortable in what they had. And there's a lot of people that are underinsured and are just not going to be able to manage to build back as much as they would love to. Mm. So we're going to lose a lot of people that want to come back home, and they just won't be able to. And that is heartbreaking. And that's actually, I would say, I have to almost gloss over that quickly, because that's the sort of pain point for me is knowing the community is going to change. But you know, looking at it optimistically, it's an incredibly unique and wonderful part of the world in Los Angeles. It has a set of attributes that are not replicable anywhere else in the city, and so people will build back there. And I believe, like I said, that when we build back, it's going to be in a safer fashion. So I think it's relatively responsible to do it. In terms of timeline, you know, I think we're spending probably a year of people, right after the fire, everyone was going to move back, you know, in gross terms. Like, yeah, we're going to go back. And then you started to have people like, I can't afford it. Or people worried about health issues. Or they're elderly. And they're like, I don't want to spend the next 4 or 5 years
right.
dealing with this process. I'm already 80 years old. You know, it's not worth it to me. So that's going to go through its process. I think my colleagues and friends sort of chatting are saying, look, if we can get to something approaching half of the lots rebuilt in 5 years, that will feel like we're doing pretty well. And then my guess is, you know, 20 years from now, you would never know. If you just came to Los Angeles for the first time and drove into the Palisades 20 years from now, you would have no sense that this was a community that had that devastation in 2025. Mm. I was on a panel discussion with a fellow named Greg who runs the planning department for the city of Santa Rosa. And he was talking about that kind of rhythm that they've seen since their big fire, I think that was 2017. And you know, he was just saying things will get better kind of almost before you know it. So, you know, starting with lot clearance, you know, at first it feels like nothing is happening. They're not clearing the debris. And then he says, but, you know, then you're going to come and you're going to see like 3 or 4 things are cleared. And then before you know it, half the lots are cleared. And then before long, they're all cleared. And then the houses start coming back. And first it's just a few, and then it's more. And then, you know, before you know it, now you're starting to count the empty lots instead of the houses that are built.
Right.
So it will come back. It will be different. It will not necessarily be worse or better. I'm hopeful that we'll still manage to have a diverse kind of stratus of socioeconomic, you know, life. I would hate to see it only become the enclave of the, you know, very wealthy people. It was nice to have, you know, the retired school teacher next to the, you know, musician or whatever that's doing really well. So sure. I hope we can hold on to at least some of that.
Yeah. Me too.
Yeah.
The Palisades is a very unique community in California. And anything else that you would like to add? Is there another topic that you think is important to the conversation that you could touch on briefly?
No, I do think it is just at the end of the day, I do want to offer hope and optimism, because I really sincerely feel that if people continue to press forward and do the right thing, the neighborhood will be a fantastic place to live again in not that many years. I would think the one concern that I have is related to soil testing and things like that, that we're not doing at the federal level like we have done in past events like this. And that certainly is something that I think needs to be paid attention to at the governmental level, because they risk scaring off a lot of people that otherwise can and would move back.
Mm.
And that would be a shame.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, Michael, I've thoroughly enjoyed the time. I really appreciate you coming in. Thank you again for joining us. And we look forward to continuing to work with you on projects.
Absolutely. Thanks, Zach.
All right. Absolutely.